This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The energy of slaves. He argues that we still behave like slaveholders in the way that we use energy, and that urgently needs to change. For more than two decades, Andrew has written about energy, economics, and the West. He's been on Locus Focus a couple times to talk about his previous books, The Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and The Future of the Continent, and Empire of the Beetle. Andrew, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you, Barbara.
Well, last time we talked was about bark beetles, which was a cheerful subject. And before that, we talked a bit about tar sands. And I'm just wondering if all the thinking and writing and speaking that you've done about the tar sands operations that are just a few hundred miles north of where you live in Alberta influenced your decision to look a little bit more broadly and deeply into our issues about our relationship to fossil fuels and the energy that they provide us.
Absolutely. I've been writing about the oil and gas industry here in Alberta for nearly 20 years. And if I hadn't been doing that, and if I hadn't been going up to Fort McMurray and looking at the huge mining operations taking place there, I don't think I would have written Energy of Slaves. I mean, when you live in a place that becomes so obsessed with hydrocarbons that in fact really becomes a plantation economy, for mining oil or gas or bitumen, then you start to ask some questions. Okay, so what is this all about? And then you really have to ask some moral and philosophical questions about the demand for energy and how we use it. And that's what got me going on Energy of Slaves, for sure.
Well, I'm interested in this whole concept of energy slaves, or the energy of slaves. My partner was looking at this book and just kind of looked at it real briefly, and she thought it was a history of slavery and didn't understand until I started talking to her about it. No, it's really about the new slavery, which is our inanimate slaves. So what do you mean when you talk about energy slaves? This is a term, actually, that's been bantered around a bit on the show. I had Richard Heimberg on a few weeks ago, and he mentioned it, and some other people who've talked about energy issues. So one thing, first of all, is how did that term come about to refer to all of our energy-saving devices as being energy slaves, and what do you mean by it specifically?
Okay, good question. First, let's make a brief nod to Leonard Cohen, a great Canadian poet who actually wrote a poem called The Energy of Slaves. But when I talk about the energy of slaves, what I'm really talking about is the fact that if you go back to ancient times, the term that the ancients used for slaves was quite specific. They called them speaking tools. Like you had animals and you had carts, and then you had your speaking tools. And so there was this idea that shackled human muscle was there to get work done, but it was a speaking tool. Now, what kind of speaking tools do we have today? Well, I mean, now we are largely powered by inanimate energy slaves. I mean, slaves that are doing machinery work for us, or they're transporting us. You know, so a car is an energy slave. A lawnmower is another energy slave. A chainsaw is an energy slave. A vacuum cleaner is an energy slave. Some of them are electrical. Some of them are digital. Some of them are mechanical. Some of them are all based on a combustion engine. But what is really remarkable, and one of the guys that first really started writing about this in the impact of the proliferation of energy slaves at our command to do work for us, was Buckminster Fuller. And he wrote in a business magazine, no less, in 1940, and using data on energy use that had been compiled by the British Army and the American Army, he roughly calculated that the average American had at their disposal, at the time of World War II, 39 energy slaves that were doing work for them every day. And a lot of it was providing comfort, a lot of the transportation, basically just a lot of different work. And he said, you know, this is probably why the United States is such an exceptional kind of place and why the United States is this rising global empire, because each and every citizen has at their command all of these inanimate slaves, these energy slaves. And if he made calculations, he said, you know, basically more than 50% of the world's energy slaves, or machines designed to do work for people, all were located in the United States. And since that time, of course, the number of machines and energy slaves has proliferated. You know, the in some ways you can look at the Industrial Revolution, you know, was about the mechanization of human muscle with machines. The Second Industrial Revolution, which is largely digital, is about the mechanization of human activities, everything from calculating to you name it, that all the sort of stuff that computers and GPS units and iPhones do for us. So we have now, I mean, the average person has just really and more than almost than 100 energy slaves working for them, the majority being powered by fossil fuels, but then you've got a whole whack powered through electricity, whether it's generated by coal fire or nuclear or whatever. So we find ourselves now in the position of having this enormous horde of slaves in our households, and these slaves have changed our social dynamics. They've changed our families. They've changed our relationship to our children. They've changed our relationship to our communities. And ultimately, they change these just the sheer immense number of these energy slaves and their ability to do work has enslaved and changed all of our relationships to the natural world. So, you know, thanks to combustion engines, you know, we can deplete groundwater. Thanks to combustion engines, we can capture more fish and deplete ocean waters. Thanks again to all manner of machines, you know, we can rip up the Midwest, plant corn, and create, you know, dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico due to the amount of ammonia, fertilizer, and pesticides that we have used. So we are using these energy slaves, we think, to kind of master the planet. And what we're finding, and at least what really kind of astounded me, because all of this astounded me, I didn't really quite understand where I was going to go with all this, or even if these ideas were all valid. I was just started out, well, you know, what if this is the case? We have used these energy slaves then to be just as abusive to our surroundings as the ancients were abusive to human slaves themselves.
Well, that answers the next question I was going to ask you about, relating to how the what you're calling energy slaves were touted from the Industrial Revolution on as work-saving devices. They're going to free people up for leisure time, for being more creative, for exploring culture. So I guess you've pretty much answered why they aren't a benefit in the larger picture. But what about some of the arguments that are made that labor-saving devices, in fact, create more time for people to be creative and to prosper?
Well, I mean, that certainly was the ideal, but that really isn't the way it has turned out. I mean, most of us are now slaves to our energy slaves. I mean, our cities are not designed for people. They're designed for cars and trucks and other energy slaves, other vehicles, right? So, the slaves outnumber us by billions, and they are increasingly, determining the pace of life and changing our social relations in so many different ways. You know, a lot of our children now spend more time with their energy slaves, with their iPods and with their games and their screens than they do with people. So they're almost, again, like a Roman household where you didn't rear your own children. Your children were reared by human slaves. And in this case, they're being raised by digital slaves. So this idea that we would somehow be liberated by employing machines to do work for us hasn't really worked out. And what we've replaced one form of slavery, actually, but with a much more insidious and form of slavery. And so we each and every one of us finds ourselves shackled to, you know, a host of machines and combustion engines, without which we apparently are quite helpless to do or hopeless to do anything. So, you know, we've solved one problem, but then sort of created a much more complicated one. And the real question, I guess, and it comes back to this, and it's the question we don't want to ask, is, well, all right, and it is a question, by the way, that actually American slaveholders used to ask. And American slaveholders in the U.S. South in the 1830s and 1840s, they weren't primarily rich people. They were often middle-class people. And they would employ somewhere between 4 to 6 or 8 slaves on average, and these slaves were used as speaking tools, largely to do agricultural work, to plant tobacco or sugar or cotton, and then the owner would use that surplus to advance his climb up the social ladder, and but they always asked themselves the question at the end of the day, well, how many slaves do I actually need to do this, and what impact do these slaves have on my relationships to my own family, my own children, the wealth they are creating? What kind of impact is that having on my own soul? Because most of these slaveholders were quite often devout Christians, and many of them came up with some rather startling answers, and they said, well, This is going to corrupt me. This is going to make my children fat and lazy. I'm living off the proceeds of someone else's labor, and this in the end will not be good for me or my family. And so, you know, so some slaveholders actually had those kind of debates, and before they died, they quite often said, "No, I'm freeing all my slaves, and my children will have to find an honest way to make a living." But the big question then for modern day folks is, all right, so we all appreciate having some energy slaves around. We want some machines fed by fossil fuels to do some kind of heavy lifting for us. But the problem is we haven't been able to establish any limits or priorities, and there's nothing equal about any of this. I mean, it's just North Americans and Europeans get to live like kings and queens of old, but the rest of the world is meanwhile getting by using, you know, 1 to 2 to 3 barrels of oil a year, while the average North American is eating his way through 24 barrels of oil, and most of it all going through energy slaves of one kind or another. So the big question here is really equity. How many do you need, and then what impact will those slaves have on the quality of your life and your relations with your children, with families, and with the community you're a part of?
Well, we're talking this morning with Andrew Nikiforuk, who's author of a book called The Energy of Slaves, and we're talking about all those inanimate objects run by hydrocarbon power that have taken over our lives and how we are masters of our own plantations. It seems that there are a lot of kind of conflicting kinds of world values and world views that come into play when we start looking at the question of how much do we need, and how have all these energy slaves affected our lives? Because you quote some people who talk about how the predominance of oil in our culture and economy has ruined the family. It basically changed the gender roles. It changed the reason for sex from being for procreation to being for pleasure. And issues where I think a lot of people who are progressive and perhaps very strong environmentalists would start to question, well, are you saying you're against abortion? Are you saying that women should remain in the home and raise children, that the only reason for sex is to have children? And then at the end of the book, you are talking about how these, particularly in petrostates, that oil holds in place strong authoritarian governments, and often the role of women is really subjugated, that they don't get education, that they have, you know, don't have access to birth control. So it seems like there's a lot of conflicting views. So I wonder, how do we sort this out when we're looking at what is the problem, the core problem with our relationship to being so dependent on oil, and how are these different shades of the issue, how do we sort through their conflicts and their contradictions?
Well, I think we have to understand, I mean, that's a really good question, Barbara, and you're bang on. I mean, these are all issues that raise some level of discomfort when we start talking about this whole subject. But what people forget is that when you change the flow of energy in any society, you will also change gender roles. You will also change political dynamics. You will change how the economy functions. You will change everything. And so what I'm trying to point out here is that when you have this explosion of cheap energy being thread through all of these energy slaves, our cultural attitudes and will be transformed and changed, and certain things that were never thought possible to believe in will become possible, and other things will fall by the wayside. And what we have failed to pay attention to is the impact of cheap energy on our attitudes and our feelings and our emotions and how we relate to other people. So that's one thing that we really haven't thought enough about. And just for one example here, okay, so let's go back to the Middle Ages when there wasn't a lot of cheap energy available, right? And what do we know about the Middle Ages? Well, we know one thing about that period in time. It was deeply religious, right? And, of course, that a lot of those religious beliefs sort of got deeply corrupted, too, at a certain point in time. But that seems to be a characteristic of a low-energy society. Now, what do we know about high-energy societies, high-energy-spending societies, whether it was ancient Rome, where the cheap energy source were slaves coming from all across Europe and North Africa, or whether it's modern North America, where cheap energy has come largely from oil, and these societies are highly materialistic, right? It's all about spending stuff and showing off all the stuff. The fact that you can accumulate these enormous surpluses because you have this access to cheap energy, and so I think it's really important for us to understand the impact of energy on people on all these different levels. And so what I'm doing in the book, I'm throwing out some of these ideas, and I'm saying like most conservatives in the United States, you know, they think that big government is the product of some kind of, you know, nasty socialist revolution underground going on that wants to construct this all-knowing huge behemoth of government to look after everyone. When in fact, when you look at changing energy flows into society, you find that big government is just like big corporations are a product of these high energy flows and of the concentration of power, and that many ways big government can be seen as a response to so much energy on the loose that the role of government then becomes much greater and becomes much more inflated because somebody has to address all of these various impacts, whether it's from managing the number of energy slaves in our streets, whether we're talking about cars, or just managing the amount of complexity that is required to monitor, measure, quantify, control, regulate all of these energy slaves that cheap energy has proliferated. So and these are different ideas, right? These are not ideas we're used to dealing with. And because I mean, I always laughed when I hear libertarians and bemoaning the state of big government, and I'm saying, look, guys, I mean, the same thing that's made big government is the same thing that has made big corporations. It's all, and the same thing that has made big mega cities. You know, it's cheap energy flows. So what's going to happen to all those things when those cheap energy flows become expensive energy flows? Are we going to see an enormous contraction? Are we going to see a great stagnation? Will things become diminished? Will we revert back to more community-based organizations? Anyway, I mean, those are some of the questions that I'm asking in the book.
Well, I'm interested in looking at how do we visualize a society where we do really rethink our relationship to our energy slaves and our sources of energy. I mean, this is what I've been thinking about ever since I finished reading your book, is like, well, what can I do away, what can I let go of in my life? What do I really need? How can I transform what I need to be a more sustainable, being produced by more sustainable energy? And how do I have to totally rethink basically everything about our society? And it's pretty overwhelming when you start thinking that way. And I'm not sure I've read any book recently that's made me spin around so much with these thoughts as your book has, which is probably a good thing. And here,
yeah, well, I made my head spin around a couple of times too, and it still is spinning.
I can imagine. Yeah,
you know, but there's a good news part to this story here, Barbara, and this is what I found really hopeful was that, I mean, there's a whole bunch of research that it looked at. Okay, how much energy do we really need? So there's a very well-known Canadian energy analyst by the name of Vaclav Smil. He's originally from Czechoslovakia. And who spent, but you know, 30 to 45 years working on these very issues. And what he found was that high energy spending has nothing to do with the quality of one's life. And in fact, the happiest people on the planet tend to be those you're actually using the least amount of energy, right? They focus most of their energy and time on stuff that matters, on their family, on the people they love, on their communities, and all of which provide an enormous amount of energy for them, a real human energy for them that helps make life comfortable and pleasant. And so Vaclav Smil figured out that, okay, right, so we're back to North Americans, we're burning our way through an average of 24 barrels of oil a year. On average, when we include electricity and nuclear and other forms of energy, you know, the average North American is spending barrels of oil equivalent, you know, in excess of 50 barrels a year. And what Vaclav Smil found out was, but you know, to be happy, to be literate, to be thoroughly engaged in your culture, to be, you know, democratic, I mean, you don't need any more than 7 barrels. And it doesn't have to be oil, right? It has to be, you know, some form of energy. But you, once you've hit consumption of around 7 barrels of oil or oil equivalent, you don't get anything more in return at the end, except environmental degradation, except a debasement of your democracy, except an obsession with acquiring stuff that you do not need, and you become, in a way, fat and lazy, like a plantation slaveholder, in the sense that you're not doing stuff for yourself anymore or for your community. You're almost entirely dependent on energy slaves of one kind or another doing stuff for you, that you become disengaged with actually being a human being. So the good news story here is really that, you know, and we're all part of this, all right? But this has been the norm for us, is to clutter our lives, and we've been told, well, you must spend more energy because spending more energy is the only way to get ahead, and it's the only way to be happy, and it's the only way to be satisfied in North American society, when in fact it's actually a social, moral, psychological, and political road to ruin, as many plantation slaveholders from the South would have warned modern Americans today. So we can get by with a lot less, and I think asking ourselves, well, what do I really need in my household, and what can I get rid of? You know, how many gadgets can I get rid of? How can I get my energy consumption down to a scale that is more human, and that is also more just, and it is also more equitable? You know, because the wealthiest people are the ones that consume the most energy. They are the ones with the largest carbon footprint. And they are also the ones who are, at the end of the day, the most abusive. So it's these big institutions and big corporations and, you know, and in many cases even big government that where all of our abuses are found, and where we also find just tremendous concentrations of energy.
Well, I was thinking about the sort of the trajectory that my own life has been on since I moved to Portland 40 years ago as a young hippie. And when I moved here, I bicycled. I didn't have a car. And then one of the first things that I needed, I discovered, was I needed to get a car. So I got an old car. And I was living out in the country, and I didn't have central heating. I just had a wood stove. But then I moved back to Portland, and I started needing to have central heating. And there's always there's a stove to cook on, a refrigerator. Those things were sort of taken for granted. But then through technological innovations, I thought I would never have a computer in my house. Why would I need a computer? But now I have 6 computers in my house, and I don't need a cell phone. And then eventually I broke down and got a cell phone. And so we start to get things because we feel that there's a social pressure that either that's pushing us towards getting it, or that we figure that there's safety reasons why, in fact, it's much better to have this device than not to have it. And I wonder, how do we start to sort through? I mean, I'm not going to do away without a furnace probably until there's a better way to heat my house. But how do we start to sift through our energy usage and devices that we get hooked onto because for some reason we think they're indispensable?
Well, I think we have to start by maybe redefining capitalism, and that maybe capitalism is really about marketing new technologies and new machines to consume cheap energy. And the problem with capitalism today now is that the cheap energy part of that story is gone. And so energy is becoming more difficult, extreme, and expensive, which means, nonetheless, we're still pouring out all of this stuff into the marketplace, and the goal of life seems to be to, how many gadgets can you acquire that will consume more energy, right? And I think, it comes down really to asking yourself some basic questions. I mean, what do I need to be happy? And what brings me happiness? Now, obviously, if you're, in journalism, and you're going to have a computer. I don't have a cell phone. I get by without a cell phone, and I just made a conscious choice, saying, okay, I don't want to go there because of the costs and demands on my time, and I don't want that gadget. I'm consciously trying to reduce the number, my dependency on certain energy slaves, right? So, and then you go through your whole household and you say, what do you need and what don't you need? And of course, and how can I simplify things? And some very good research basically shows you really we don't need more than about 200 items in our household, and again, to be happy and entirely fulfilled. And I think, it's a great truism that the more you have, the less you appreciate.
Now, those 200 items, how many of those are produced by, are dependent on electricity to run, and how many of them are things like musical instruments or a piece of furniture?
That's right. And, and there's all kinds of cooking implements that are great that don't need to be electrified. Like, it's always, we always go beyond. We never ask ourselves, do you really need a blender? Do you really need a waffle maker? Do you really need all that stuff? Or maybe, maybe you can get by with just a couple of pots and pans and not have your kitchen being a plantation for electrical gadgets, right? But I think, these are questions that each and everyone has to ask themselves. And I think that, Ivan Illich, the great Catholic theologian, raised all of these issues back in the 1970s, during the first great oil shock, when the United States domestic oil production peaked and the United States became dependent on oil resources from the Middle East. And Illich said, maybe we don't have an energy crisis. Maybe what we really have instead is a crisis about this insatiable demand for more and more slaves, and that maybe now is the time to ask, what does it really mean to be free? So, how many slaves do you actually need? What is the bare minimum that you actually need? And what happens when you exceed that bare minimum, and what happens to your own freedom, your own soul, your own heart, your own family, as you find yourself enslaved by these devices that tend to dominate one's life and eat up one's time and are actually quite demanding in many ways.
Well, if you're just tuning in this morning, we're talking on Locus Focus with Andrew Nikiforuk, who's author of a book called Energy of Slaves, and we're talking about all these energy-saving devices, energy-saving for us, but really energy-consuming devices that we are so dependent on that are our inanimate slaves. At the end of the book, you have a very powerful example of perhaps the whole energy slave system gone awry, and you talk about the impacts of the tsunami and earthquake and then nuclear meltdown in Japan 2 years ago. And I wonder if you could talk about what that raised for you in terms of looking at a system that is so out of whack and out of touch with the natural system.
Well, I think the story of Japan is a very telling one. And, I mean, here's a country that has no oil, right? So it didn't have this cheap energy supply, let's say the United States did. And that made the United States such an exceptional high energy spending country or empire, much the same way that coal made England an empire in the 19th century. And so Japan had a problem then. Japan just, you know, couldn't achieve the same standard of living or economic prosperity as defined by modern economists unless they spent a lot of oil. So they did. They imported it. They turned it into cars and electronic machinery. They had their own revolution, industrial revolution, and this all happened, you know, after World War II in the 50s and the 60s with enormous social and environmental and political costs. At one point, Japan was putting so many cars on the road that these cars were killing as many as 10,000 pedestrians a year in Japan. So, but Japan had its brief moment of glory, and then with oil prices and oil price shocks, they began to realize in the 1970s how vulnerable they were, that their whole economy was based on the import of cheap energy from abroad, and that when there was a crisis of some sort or another, this cheap energy was no longer cheap. It was expensive. And so they could clearly see their dependency. That drove them to nuclear energy. So, you know, they went on this nuclear energy program in the 70s and the 80s and 90s and built like crazy. And, of course, nuclear energy, every energy has a cost, and nuclear energy here was, the costs were phenomenal. The secrecy, the corruption, the hiding of pollution events and scandals. Nonetheless, nuclear power then played this rather dominant role in Japanese society, and to get children and women comfortable with the idea of nuclear power, nuclear power plants even built amusement parks, you know, outside of their reactors to get people to let down their guard and to stop asking questions about this incredible concentrated form of energy. And wherever you have concentrations of energy, you then have, you know, ultimately these incredible abuses of power and the lying and the corruption. And this all came to a head with the tsunami and the earthquake. And now Japan is having a real reckoning, it is having to contend with the fragility of an oil-based society. And Japan used oil to re-engineer Japan, you know, to re-engineer its rivers, re-engineer its forests, re-engineer its ocean beds. They thought that the oil could buy them some stability in terms of the fact that, you know, it's a pretty volatile place geologically. I mean, you have tsunamis and you have earthquakes and you have huge storms and you have incredible rains. And they thought that oil could provide for Japan some kind of Disneyland existence and remove the volatility of that comes from just being in the place they are in. And of course, none of that came true. So the reckoning is there, and Japan is now really one of the world's first countries that has to contend with the social and political consequences of high energy spending now that they can no longer afford it. Much the same way that Europe is now beginning to have to wrestle with the same issues, and much in the same way that even many parts of the United States are beginning to have to deal with this. And so Japan is kind of a window in some ways to the future of how difficult and problematic it is going to be to get off oil once you've built this incredible infrastructure, all based on the assumption that cheap energy will always be there. Well, those slaves are now disappearing. Or, in fact, if they're not disappearing, then we can no longer afford to employ them in the same numbers as we did before, doing the same kind of work. And so Japan is, to me, really is a fascinating case of what happens to a high energy spender when they have to pay, when the bills all come due at once.
So what do you see for the future? Because from what you just said, it sounds pretty bleak.
Well, it not necessarily bleak. It means, we're so used to living with such incredible abundance of stuff. But, I think this energy shift is actually an opportunity for us to become more human again, and to stop behaving like gods who think that we can control and do anything anywhere, anytime we please. And so what do we use high energy spending for? Well, we've used it to overproduce all kinds of junk and stuff. And so the emphasis has always been on quantity. Well, maybe as energy becomes more expensive and scarce, maybe we can begin to focus now on quality. And that would be a good thing. We use cheap energy to make cheap food, right? And we've used cheap food to basically unsettle agriculture everywhere in the world. And again, as energy becomes more expensive and more scarce, maybe we will begin to appreciate a good meal as opposed to a combination of fats, sugars, and oils. So, and then, we've used high energy spending to basically to become disengaged, to become distracted. Well, maybe with lower energy spending, we will become more attentive and more reflective. We've used high energy spending to accelerate the speed of everything. Well, maybe with a reduction in energy use and demand, we will once again understand the beauty of slowing down. The slow food movement is all a good illustration of that sort of trend. So there are a lot of positive things that can happen, and it's almost like after you've been addicted to crack cocaine or crystal meth or alcohol. And then you can't envision a future without all these artificial highs. But then once you sober up and you struggle to recover your original self and spirit, it's only then that you begin to realize, okay, this is not so bad being myself, being a walking at a normal pace. Engaging people, actually waking up in the morning and feeling pretty good, and doing stuff with my own hands, and paying more attention to how I use my own energy than to how I spend energy in machines. So I don't think the future is necessarily bleak. I think there are a lot of really powerfully good things that can happen. I think the problem is that governments and corporations aren't terribly interested in helping us get there. And that's where some of the bleak and dismal stuff is going to take place. But I'm still very enheartened by the fact that we have things like the transition movement, where you have communities around the world grassroots organizations where they are come to meetings every week and they discuss, what am I going to do that's going to make a real difference in my community when things all fall apart? You know, how many fruit trees am I going to plant? What kind of gardens am I going to help my community put together? How will we do the composting? How can we cooperatively reestablish green grocers and bakers in our communities? How can we make it easier to walk in this community or to bicycle? How can we make sure that, people who need help in our community, you know, get the extra energy they need from the community itself? You know, like we did 30, 40 years ago with bees and community work. And so there are lots of people, ordinary people, who are spending their energies in very positive ways to prepare for what I think is going to be a fairly challenging future in many ways. But that holds lots of great promise.
Well, it's been really great talking with you, Andrew, and I hope we have more conversations in the future.
Well, likewise. Thank you so much, Barbara. Your questions were just really, really extraordinarily good ones.
Great. Now I'm looking forward to talking to you without the audience to talk more about tar sands in the coming weeks. So we'll be in touch.
All right. Thank you.
We've been talking with author Andrew Nikiforuk, who's author of Energy of Slaves, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. In the upper right-hand corner, there's a search bar. Type in Locus Focus and today's date, and you'll get the audio. Next week, we'll be taking an environmental perspective on our relationship to our dogs with Ted Carasote, who's author of Pooka's Promise, and that will be our Earth Day special. I'm Barbara Bernstein, my engineer. Here's Carlos Chavez. I'm going to say farewell today. Thanks so much for all the engineering you've been doing, Carlos, and good luck with your future plans. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening.
Can it be that a man like me been doing hard time and committed no crime?
Juan Melendez spent 17 years on Florida's death row for a crime he did not commit. Now exonerated and released from prison, Juan Melendez shares his story of injustice, survival, and hope. Tune in to Prison Pipeline, April 15th at 6:30 p.m.
Now I'm free. Now I'm free.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is New York Times reporter Michael Moss. Michael Moss was the recipient of the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for explanatory reporting for his investigation into the dangers of contaminated meat and the surprising and troubling holes in the nation's system to keep our food safe. He was also a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 2006 for his reporting on the lack of protective armor for soldiers in Iraq, and in 1999 for a team effort on Wall Street's emerging influence in the nursing home industry. He's here today on Health Watch to talk about his new book, the number one New York Times bestseller, Salt, Sugar, Fat, How the Food Giants Hooked Us. Welcome to Health Watch, Michael Moss.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So you start out Salt, Sugar, Fat with a meeting in 1999, 11 men, the heads of America's largest food companies from Pillsbury and Kraft and Nabisco to Coca-Cola. Can you tell us why you started with that meeting and the significance of it?
Yeah, I came across this meeting early on in my reporting through gaining access to a trove of internal documents that put me at the table of the largest food companies as they were planning, plotting, formulating their way to creating new products, and also dealing with the growing concern about the health issues in their products. And This meeting was just extraordinary. It was early 1999. These CEOs, who rarely get together for anything, got together in private to talk about none other than the emerging obesity crisis. And the most amazing thing about it is that, you know, getting up in front of them was nobody but one of their own, a senior executive at Kraft, who was armed with 114 slides. And he laid at their feet responsibility for not only the obesity crisis, but for diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. He even started linking their foods to several cancers. And he said to them, look, even if you don't acknowledge responsibility, the lawyers who went after Big Tobacco are going to come after you. And he pleaded with them to collectively start doing the right thing by consumers.
And then what happened with his plea? We have one company, Kraft, standing out and making this suggestion that they change course.
From his perspective, the meeting was an utter failure because he knew that he needed to get them to act collectively because of the fierce competition among them and the fierce pressure from Wall Street to produce profits. And so what we've seen is on a couple of occasions, some of the companies individually have tried to come up with an anti-obesity initiative, take some of the steps he was suggesting back then, only to sort of get beaten back by Wall Street. And indeed, his own company, he was able to convince them to adopt, you know, several remarkable things. One, they cut back on their marketing to kids, the most sugary products. Two, they reconfigured the labeling, the disclosures on their labels to be more forthright with consumers about serving size. They decided, especially in those snack packs that have more than one serving, their own data showed that so many people eat the whole bag, and yet the calories would be listed only per tiny serving. They started putting the entire calories of the entire bag on the label, so you could see that while they're doing the math. And then, kind of most incredibly, they turned to their scientists and said, hey, you know, you will no longer be allowed to use an unlimited amount of salt, sugar, and fat in formulating Allure in your products. We're going to cap that. And, you know, it worked to some extent, and it didn't work to others, and mostly Kraft, you know, came under intense competition.